This is the psychology which today rules over the whole world, excepting a few individuals who have grown out of this exclusivism. But otherwise, this is the general tendency today. Even those who hold religious conferences, in order to arrive at understanding, even when they claim that others have got some truth or much truth, they still try to believe in their own life, in their own being, that after all, my religion is superior to all the others. That I have a truth which none of others has got. This is the psychology which divides the world today very seriously. It is in this context that the Gita is being studied now by us. So let us not fall into this kind of a pit. Because all these exclusivists, when they study their own religious scripture, they want people to accept every word written there. As Sri Aurobindo says, even a comma or a diacritical mark which is there, they would not like it to be changed, as if it is the last word in the truth. Now this raises a question as to what is the authority of truth? How do you know that truth is truth? And why is it that so many people in the world have upheld one book, one scripture as containing the highest truth? What is the reason for this? And it is in that context we have to ask ourselves, whether the Gita that we are going to study, are we going to make the same kind of claim that the highest truth is here and no other truth anywhere exists, and that every word that is given here is absolutely final and there has been no expansion at all. Fortunately, in India we have a tradition. It says, Anantaha Vedaha. The Vedas are infinite. And this is a very great liberating truth. So that you may say that even the Vedas that we read are not claimed to be the truth or the only truth, exclusively something that is confined in the four corners of the scriptures that we read as Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda. If the Vedas are Ananta, then there are so many things still remaining to be told, to be revealed, to be brought out. Now if that is true of the origin of the Gita, then what to talk of the Gita itself? So this is a fortunate circumstance in India, that right from the beginning our minds are free from this kind of bigotry. Although this bigotry exists, but basically in our own tradition there is an opening of a gate which can liberate us from this bigotry. Now it is in that spirit that we are going to study the Gita, not as something which is finally true, for all time to be true, but to see what truth it contains, and even if the whole of the Gita is nothing but the truth, to keep in consciousness that there are many things which are not in the Gita, many other truths which are not in the Gita. There are even, for example, there are many truths of the Veda which are not in the Gita. The Gita may be regarded as a quintessence of the Veda, but the richness of the Veda is not in the Gita. The Gita is an episode at a given occasion, and whatever was relevant to that occasion has been answered. But although it is called the quintessence of the Upanishads, the richness of the Upanishads is not in the Gita. Therefore, we cannot make a claim that all that is true is in the Gita. That the Gita gives you the final word of the truth, and that there is nowhere any truth anywhere else, or that whatever truth anywhere else exists is subordinate to this truth. This is not the attitude with which we are going to study the Gita. And this has to be very clear in the minds of everyone, that if you study, it may therefore be useful in approaching an ancient scripture such as the Veda, Upanishads or the Gita, to indicate precisely the spirit in which we approach it, and what exactly we think we may derive from it, that is of value to humanity and its future. First of all, there is undoubtedly a truth, one and eternal, which we are seeking, from which all other truth derives, by the light of which all other truth finds its right place, explanation and relation to the scheme of knowledge. But precisely for that reason, it cannot be shut up in a single transient formula. It is not likely to be found in its entirety or in all its bearings in any single philosophy or scripture or uttered altogether and forever by any one teacher, thinker, prophet or avatar. Nor has it been wholly found by us if our view of it necessitates the intolerant exclusion of the truth underlying other systems. For when we reject passionately, we mean simply that we cannot appreciate and explain. Secondly, this truth, though it is one and eternal, expresses itself in time and through the mind of man. Therefore, every scripture must necessarily contain two elements, one temporary, perishable, belonging to the ideas of the period and country in which it was produced, the other eternal and imperishable and applicable in all ages and countries. Moreover, in the statement of the truth, the actual form given to it, the system and arrangement, the metaphysical and intellectual mold, the precise expression used must be largely subject to the mutations of time and cease to have the same force. For the human intellect modifies itself always. Continually dividing and putting together, it is obliged to shift its divisions continually and to rearrange its synthesis. It is always leaving old expression and symbol for new. Or if it uses the old, it so changes its connotation, or at least its exact content and association, that we can never be quite sure of understanding an ancient book of this kind, precisely in the sense and spirit it bore to its contemporaries. What is of entirely permanent value is that which, besides being universal, has been experienced, lived, and seen with a higher than the intellectual vision.